Being overweight is a risk factor for not only breast cancer, but esophageal cancer, pancreatic cancer, and many other cancers as well. And in this country, we do have a problem with weight status. And Michigan is top third, three in the country for being overweight. So maintaining physical activity to try and achieve as close to your ideal body weight as possible is very important. And mechanistically, how that works is that in the breast, the tissue itself is epithelial tissue. Those are cells that compose the ducts and the gland tissue that sit in an environment of fat. That's what the remainder of the breast is. So when you have excess adipose tissue, that fat actually secretes cytokines or chemicals that stimulate the stem cells. And the stem cells, we now believe, are the source of cancer. We used to believe that any cell in the body can transform to a cancer cell and generate a tumor. And now we have mounting data in the last 10 years that show us that these early cells that are called tissue-specific stem cells are basically, they have the capacity to reproduce themselves or to divide into daughter cells that make up that entire gland. So they can divide into alveolar cells, into the lobules that actually secrete the milk, and that's what maintains the tissue over time. But those early cells are the ones that have the capacity to generate cancer. So how do we target those cells specifically with what we eat or what we do? Well, one of the things is that we know alcohol, more than one glass of wine per average in a week, so average consumption, actually increases the risk of breast cancer. And it increases by 10% for every additional glass on average. So moderate consumption, particularly of red wine, which has resveratrol in it, actually may decrease the risk of heart disease, but promotes the risk of cancer. So that's something to be aware of. In the diet, the things that can be helpful are cruciferous vegetables, like cauliflower, broccoli, asparagus, that family of foods, that has a chemical in there called sulforaphane, and carboxyindole methane that reduces the ability of cancer cells to proliferate, to divide and grow. Another category of foods that's extremely helpful in reducing the risk of cancer is berries. There have been a number of studies that have been done by an investigator named Gary Stoner, who worked with farmers to reproduce standardized batches of strawberries and raspberries and freeze-dried them and gave them to people who were at risk of esophageal cancer and pancreatic cancer. And he actually showed that with just that intervention, eating more berry product, he was able to reduce the incidence of cancer. So one question I'm asked frequently is, I have an estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. Should I eat soy? Or should I not eat soy, right? So many women use soy products to try and help with hot flashes that may happen with menopause and the changes associated with losing estrogen from the environment. That's because soy contains a phytoestrogen, that's a plant source of estrogen. And when it's consumed as a food, we know from the epidemiological studies in China and countries where it's a very common element of the diet, soy products, that there's actually a lower risk of cancer. And now we're beginning to understand from rodent studies and intervention studies that if you take the element of soy that is the active ingredient, that is called genistein or daidzein, the two chemicals, and you put them in a capsule and you give them to patients, they actually promote risk of cancer in certain situations. Because the notion is, if a little is good, then more of it must be better. So instead of eating it as a food, let me take a supplement with this. And actually, we know that most of the natural compounds have a biphasic activity. At the lower doses, they actually have a cancer risk reductive property, where you take that same compound at a very high dose, and it has the opposite effect. We know this also about vitamin D. Vitamin D is very controversial in the literature right now. In this area, many of us are vitamin D deficient because we don't get enough exposure to sunlight, and vitamin D is made in our skin and converted to the active form by the kidney. For that reason, it's helpful to take vitamin D supplements. The question is, what dose is enough? And even the nutritional experts are arguing about the effective dose. Is it 5,000 international units? Is it 1,000 international units that is going to be the sufficient dose to correct the deficiency? But if you actually have a normal vitamin D level and you are given a supplement of vitamin D in addition to that, it's actually been shown to increase the risk of colon cancer. So it's not always protective to take supplements when your nutritional status is replete. If you consume natural foods with these active ingredients in there, oftentimes there are enzymes that help your body to utilize those nutrients more efficiently. For example, broccoli. We know that George Bush hated broccoli. Banned it from Air Force One, right? Broccoli has that compound sulforaphane that I mentioned, and that compound actually inhibits the stem cells. So you would think, oh, then I need sulforaphane. I don't need broccoli, right? Sulforaphane is actually not stable when it's isolated as a chemical. So it's very difficult to get sufficient concentration into the body when you take it as a capsule. But if you eat broccoli, a sufficient portion to equal that dose, the blood levels of sulforaphane are actually detectable in the human system. So the message is that the way we consume those cancer preventive compounds is also important. There are two spice isolates that have shown a lot of promise in reducing the risk of breast cancer. One of them is curcumin from turmeric. Some of you may know the yellow spice that's used in curry powder. That's actually a powder that's made from a root that looks like ginger. And it's used as a spice, like saffron, to color the food, and it has a very delicate flavor. It does not have a pungent taste like peppers. That and a compound called piperine from black pepper have actually inhibited the stem cells in the laboratory, in the petri dishes, as well as inhibited the growth of breast tumors in mice that were given a carcinogen to stimulate breast cancer. And they were actually injected with breast cancer cells in a different rodent model. In both of those models, this compound inhibited the ability of the tumor to form. So the question is, will it work in humans? And it's been tested in humans in various clinical trials, and we know that we cannot reproduce the same blood levels that cause these effects in the petri dish and in the mice. Well, why not? This is a fat-soluble spice and does not dissolve in water. So when we take this compound that naturally occurs in the diet and it's cooked in oil and it's cooked in combination with ginger and other things in the Indian diet, and you put it as a powder in a capsule and you swallow it into the stomach, what are the gastric juices? They're water. They're not oil. So 97% of the dose that we're giving patients in clinical trials is just eliminated as such because it doesn't dissolve. So even as investigators, we have to step back a moment and say, what was it that was reducing the risk? And why is it that we can't recapitulate that same effect? We also know that combinations can affect the way compounds act. In natural food, in the diet, curcumin and piperine in the Indian diet are often used together. The black pepper is the source of piperine, and curcumin is from turmeric. So when you cook in Indian food, those are used together in an oil medium. If you look at Ayurvedic medicine, the Indian form of medicine, the isolates are never given as a single agent. They're given together. Gingerol, curcumin, and piperine, the three compounds together, are called trikatu. So if you go back mechanistically and look, why was it that for centuries that combination was used to promote wound healing? It was used to decrease inflammation, and it was used to fight cancer. And there was efficacy by observational studies. So why was that? We now know that piperine, cancer cells, particularly the stem cells, have pumps on the outside that pump out chemotherapy agents. That's why the stem cells can sometimes be resistant to chemotherapy and actually go up in number because we're killing the other cells, the more differentiated cells with the chemotherapy, but the stem cells are resistant. And cancer can lie dormant for years and years and then come back in some individuals. We all have heard stories about women who had a good period of time, and then for some reason or another, they had a stress in their life, or they got ill, and suddenly the cancer came back. That's because of that innate resistance. Piperine blocks off those drug efflux pumps. And curcumin was naturally being pumped out by those pumps. So it's one way that using the combinations helps things to work with each other to help protect against risk of cancer. We also know that from the large national studies, there's one called the Women's Health Intervention Study. That was 48,000 plus patients, women with breast cancer already, early stage, treated with chemotherapy. And after they were done with the chemotherapy, then put into an intervention study where they were randomized. Half the women were sent to a dietitian and advised to decrease the fat content in their diet to less than 20% of fat calories, to increase their fruits and vegetable servings to at least 5 servings of fruits and vegetables, 1 at least dark green and 1 yellow in color, and to increase their grain servings, whole grains, to 6 servings or more in a day, and exercise. And just that intervention was able to, without changing the medication or any of their other treatments, reduce the risk of recurrence of breast cancer in this group of patients. And if you look specifically at the most aggressive kind of breast cancer, the triple negative breast cancer, which you cannot treat with hormonal therapies, that decreased by 50% with the diet change alone. But how many physicians are aware of that or talk to their patients about that? If I had a penny for every time a patient asked me, what can I do to change my outcome, I would be a millionaire. Because that's what we all want. When you have a diagnosis of cancer, you feel like there's a loss of control. And you want to be able to take that control back. Well, what I'm here to tell you is, it makes a difference. What you eat every day definitely makes a difference to your outcome. We know this now from these clinical trials. We know that exercise helps to protect you from your risk of recurrence. And emotional responses are also important. So if you're able to achieve peace, if you feel comfortable with your physicians, if you have a community and you go to church and you have women or men that you feel comfortable talking to, all of that helps to ease that risk. You've heard about the fight or flight response, right? The body kicks out adrenaline when we're in a stressful situation. And your blood pressure goes up. And your pulse rate goes up. And that affects so many other cytokines. What happens when you're scared if your cancer is going to come back? There are actually cytokines that are secreted in the body that can modify and stimulate that stem cell pool. So being able to achieve that peace of mind and manage the stress and find your comfort is very important as well in lifestyle modification. So the things that are most important to help reduce the risk are the number of fruits and vegetable servings, at least 5 or more with the multiple colors, reducing the fat in the diet to less than 20% of calories, including soy foods, but avoiding supplements of soy products, and the spices, curcumin and piperine. Cinnamic acid is another one from the cinnamon that can have activity as well to help reduce the risk of cancer, and moderation of alcohol. Exercise at least 3 times a week for 30 minutes or more to raise your heart rate and get the blood flow moving is also very important. These are the things that have been clinically shown to reduce your risk of recurrence of cancer. Do any of you have questions on these?
Mm-hmm. Would you recommend any type of book that offers recipes and that are beneficial?
Yes, absolutely. There is a good book written by a registered dietitian who herself had 2 different breast cancers and a childhood brain cancer. And she's a survivor. She is one of the proponents of supporting sustainable agriculture and local food production to maintain the nutritional quality of the food. Her name is Diana Dyer, D-Y-E-R. All proceeds from that book go back to research to prevent breast cancer. And she actually talks about her own experience with cancer and then recipes, including soy-based shakes. She's a very big proponent of soy products. So there are good ideas in there.
Can I ask you one more question? Mm-hmm. What happens when we don't know whether our vegetables are GMO? What happens to the nutrition in those vegetables or fruits?
So the vegetables and fruits that have been shipped over long distances.
That are modified,
and
so forth.
The modification actually is not necessarily a bad thing, because these are bred to adapt for larger production agriculturally. Sometimes the nutritional profile of that particular product will change, but it's based more in the soil nutrients in which it grows. So if pepper has been grown in California and shipped to us in Michigan, the transport itself has lost over 50% of the vitamin C in that pepper. So if you were to eat a locally grown pepper, you would have a far different nutrient content for that same size pepper. So it's not necessarily the modification as it is the shipping and... Mm-hmm.
But you would say it's better to eat the pepper versus not eat the pepper, regardless whether it's GMO or not, because that pepper's going to help you.
Right. It's better to eat the fruits and vegetables and emphasize...
And I have a question. What about frozen?
So frozen...
I know you want fresh, but in the wintertime it's, you know...
Mm-hmm. Actually, frozen is much better in maintaining the nutrient profile of a food than canned or pickled. So frozen is usually done within a half an hour of that food being picked in most commercial production. So it's actually a reasonable way to get food.
Do you have any thoughts on switching to a plant-based whole foods diet and getting rid of all animal products? Do you know of studies that have shown that that's beneficial? I mean,
so there was a physician named, is a physician named Dean Ornish, who, when he was a resident, got an external grant from the NIH to get a group of people with heart disease who had documented coronary artery blockage and put them not in a drug program, but in a lifestyle program. And he took them to a completely vegetarian diet, less than 20% of calories from fat, emphasis on whole foods and grains, made them meditate, made them have group sessions where they talked about their stresses, because he felt isolation and loneliness was a huge component here as well, and then made them exercise. And with that alone, he repeated coronary angiograms and showed that the blockage was reversed. No drugs, no cholesterol-reducing medications, no change in blood pressure, no surgeries or stents. That shows you the power of lifestyle change. Now, has that been studied exactly that way for cancer risk reduction? We do know that animal fat can increase the risk of certain cancers. Breast cancer directly, the type of fat is very important. So monounsaturated fats and omega-3 fatty acids that you find in fish and fish oils are actually protective. The ones that promote the risk of cancer are the saturated fats in animal products. So yes, there could be a benefit from switching from an animal-based diet, which we heavily emphasize in the U.S., to a more plant-based diet. Actually, humans evolved, and if you look at the length of the GI tract, they evolved from an agrarian background and were meant genetically to eat a plant-based diet. So coconut oil is this interesting fad that happened in the nutritional community. It's actually a saturated fat. Anything that actually is a solid at room temperature is going to have more saturated fat in it. But it's a plant-based saturated fat. So it actually is not quite as harmful as, say, lard or cooking with bacon grease or in any animal fat. but it is not as healthful as the olive oils and the polyunsaturated.
So I've always stayed away from it, and now I've heard people saying, oh, yeah, we use coconut oil, it's great.
Right. True. Well, it does add a flavor to your food, yeah. But yeah.
Okay.
So other questions. Someone asked about good resources with recipes, and there's another good book that I often recommend to my patients, and it's called Anti-Cancer, A New Way of Life. And I have no relationship with this author, but he is a physician himself and had a brain tumor himself. And he went and did a systematic review of the literature, including the scientific studies of what's helpful and what's not in lifestyle modification. So he covers not only diet, but exercise, stress management, the clinical trial information, and what objective evidence we have of the benefit. And it's a good read. It's an interesting read.
Do you know the name of it? The book is called
Anti-Cancer, A New... David Servan Schreiber. Last name is S-E-R-W-A-N hyphen S-C-H-R-I-E-B-E-R. And another common thing with patients is to come in with a bag full of supplements and ask me, should I be taking this Reiki mushroom? Should I be taking this milk thistle? And the question is, where do we find objective, good information about what supplements may be helpful and what supplements may be harmful? The Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center's Integrative Medicine Program. This is a website that if you type into Google these words, you will get this website. And it has a lay version and a physician version of a computerized website where you can enter Reiki mushrooms, and it will tell you these are the studies that have been conducted in the cancer cells, this is the finding in rodents, and these are the human data that are available about this. And what does that mean?
What are the words?
Memorial Sloan Kettering's Cancer Center Integrative Medicine Program. And that will bring up the website. And it's actually alphabetized, so you can just either scroll through and click by letter and see what kind of herbal supplements are there and information is available. And most physicians aren't aware of this. So one of the things that I do is I'm an active member of the Cancer Prevention Committee of the American Society for Clinical Oncology. So how do we educate oncologists in this country to be able to respond to patient questions? In medical school, there is not one nutritional class. So the physician who is typically regarded as the expert in what should I eat to manage this diet, disease that I have, actually usually is not qualified to answer that question. And most of them will kind of look at their shoes. So we're trying to raise the awareness, even amongst the medical community, of what resources they can refer to. The American Cancer Society and the National Cancer Institute both have printable, downloadable materials on diet information, what you can do during treatment to manage the side effects of chemotherapy, when you have dry mouth, when you're nauseated, how do you get your protein, how do you prevent weight loss during treatment. When you're getting steroids, how do you prevent weight gain during breast cancer treatment? All of these topics are addressed in these publications. How many of us physicians are actually passing those along to our patients? With the pressured interactions we have now, if we have 5 minutes, 10 minutes quality time with a patient, we're lucky. So I want to make sure that you're aware those resources are available to you.
There's also two really good places you can call. You can call MD Anderson in Houston. Mm-hmm. They have a special line, and you can just pour your guts out to them, and they'll look up everything that's relevant that's going on. And then the Cleveland Clinic, they're also very good. And they see so many different kinds that if you have something that's a little off, they can say, well, we saw 50 of those, and Sloan Kettering saw, so you should call there. I've done that a couple times, and they've been, I mean, they'll just sit there and talk to you for hours. So.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question about that, what you mentioned about vitamin D, because
mm-hmm.
I hadn't heard that too much is not a good thing, because I was deficient, and so, you know, my oncologist is all about it. But So how do you know, like, when you, do you take it for a while and then realize, gosh, I probably shouldn't be on 5,000, or, you know?
You should actually...
Do you, like, test your blood every 6 months? Is that what you recommend?
You should actually have had a value checked to know that you're deficient.
Yes.
And then 3 months later, after you've been on the high dose of the 5,000, you should have it rechecked to see where you are.
And then if you're normal, then you just... Lay it off
mm-hmm.
completely?
You know? No, then you have a maintenance dose then, so you go back to the standard.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Because isn't vitamin D something you can go off it and your levels go right back down again?
It depends on the production. So in this area, in summertime, most of us are reasonably adequate. But 9 months of the year, you're pretty safe to be taking your vitamin D supplement. Either that or head to Florida for a while.
Can you tell us a little bit about some research you're doing right now?
Yes, absolutely. So I started out training in nutrition at Michigan State University, which is one of the top in this country for nutrition, and wanted very much from the beginning to help people with prevention in addition to just treating the disease that was already there. And so I overlapped the nutrition training in med school and did what was called the physician scientist training program. And went on to additional training specifically in cancer biology at University of Michigan, looking at stem cells and the signaling pathways within the cells, but also how can we bring this down to a very concrete level for patients in terms of the diet and in terms of actual food products. And I'm fortunate that I have both NIH funding as well as Komen Foundation funding. And one of the things we are looking at is that combination of the curcumin and piperine, particularly in women at high risk for breast cancer. For example, in this country, we have over 1 million women with ductal carcinoma in situ. That's a stage breast cancer, a non-invasive breast cancer. And we know that in those women, even though the standard of care is surgery to remove that lesion and then radiation, in the high-risk patients, tamoxifen can help reduce the risk. Only 1 in 5 women who's recommended tamoxifen will actually take it for 5 years because there are so many side effects of hot flashes and risk of blood clots and risk of early stage uterine cancer that is a fear for patients, maybe even a disproportionate fear. So it's not widely accepted, even though we know it reduces the risk of breast cancer. These nutritional supplements, the curcumin and piperine, actually have the potential to reverse the cancer change in the ductal carcinoma in situ and potentially reduce the risk of breast cancer coming back as an invasive breast cancer or as another ductal carcinoma in situ. But if you're trying specifically to target the stem cells, how do you tell whether you've made a difference or not? One of the big challenges is to run a clinical trial, you get X amount of money, say $200,000 to get a clinical trial. That will only cover follow-up for a short period of time. So in a 6 month or 3 month intervention where you give someone these supplements, how do you show whether or not you've made a difference with their stem cells? So what we're doing is in part studying the nutritional agents that have the ability by taking stem cells from women who have plastic surgeries. They have excess breast tissue, and for whatever reason, back pain, headaches, aesthetic reasons, they have surgery. They do not have cancer. That tissue is typically thrown away by the hospitals. What we do is ask for their consent and collect that tissue. We isolate the stem cells, and then we test the nutritional agents so that we use it as a screening system to see which ones have the ability to control the stem cell growth and proliferation and change to cancer. And we take those forward into human clinical trials based on information of the dose that is safe in humans and based on rodent studies about the mechanisms as well. So I have funding to look at women with ductal carcinoma in situ. The core biopsy is where you make the diagnosis. And ultimately, the whole lesion is removed. The stem cells aren't evenly distributed throughout all that tissue. It's actually at the leading invasive edge of a cancer. So where you took your core biopsy very much will change what the result is that you're going to see about the stem cells. So step one is that we're comparing that core biopsy to the resection tissue. That trial is already ongoing, and we are actually collecting tissue from women in West Michigan who consent, and I've gotten already patients at St. Mary's. the second phase of that study is, okay, if we know that these two are comparable in the stem cell signaling and distribution, let's give those women 28 days of these nutritional agents before they have their final surgery and see if we've made a difference from where they were to the final surgical resection, specifically in the stem cell that can cause that recurrence of cancer. That trial will be open next year.
So of these spices, do you recommend just using the spices? Or
yes.
And how do you spell the lung? Is it P-E-R-C-U-M-E-N?
Curcumin is C-U-R. C-U-M-I-N. And that's in turmeric. The spice itself is called turmeric, T-U-R-M-E-R-I-C. And it's similar to saffron in flavoring. You can use it in soups and broths and so forth. Piperin isn't black pepper. So is the pepper you're shaking on your food getting into your bloodstream at any concentration that's going to help your stem cells? And the answer is, we had a bunch of volunteers in our lab, including myself, where we drew the blood because we were trying to figure out this assay. How do we actually detect the piperin in your bloodstream? And we found the way you do that is you put in known amounts of piperin into the volunteer blood, and then you extract it to see if you can detect exactly the correct concentration. That's how you know you've got a good assay. Problem was, when we did that assay, every single person's blood already had piperin in there before we put it in there. So what does that tell you? Yeah. The problem with most of the polyphenols, like green tea, resveratrol, curcumin, all these wonderful things you hear about in the news that have wonderful potential in the petri dish in the rodent studies, they don't get into the human blood in sufficient concentration the way we're giving them. And we're giving them wrong. So there's some learning curve that's happening there. But when you use them in combination, they do get in. Piperin is slightly different. It's not a polyphenol. The structure itself is called an alkaloid. And it does get in just from what you're eating. We were able to detect it in every single patient sample. So I went back and checked in another study called the Mediterranean Diet Intervention Study, which was conducted to help reduce the risk of colon cancer. So we had actual dietary information that was collected from the patients, and we had blood. But the blood was collected first thing in the morning after a 12-hour fast. So is your piperin level going to be even detectable 12 hours after the last meal that you had? We kind of anticipated maybe not. But out of 150 patients, there were only 3 in which we couldn't detect piperin. The rest of them had appreciable concentrations. And it's a compound that's very potent against stem cells.
And are you saying it's the same as black pepper?
I'm saying just eating the black pepper is getting enough of your piperin concentration into the blood that it is helpful. So part of the Mediterranean diet is also the spices they're using, not only the olive oils and the emphasis on fresh fruits and vegetables, but also the spices.
Fresh ground or just?
Fresh ground has more of the piperin in it. Mm-hmm.
Is there a good place to buy it?
Penzies is a good store. There are many natural food stores in the Grand Rapids area where the spices themselves are available. Mm-hmm. And there's actually a difference in the piperin content between the black and the colored peppers, green and red. They have less. It should be the black pepper. But I have a number of other trials as well, and one of them is examining the diabetes drug metformin. As I mentioned, when we're overweight, there's signaling that goes from the fat to the stem cells to promote the risk of cancer. And that is more potent in diabetics when they cannot utilize the sugar properly. Cancer cells grow on sugar. And so when the rest of the body cannot metabolize the sugar correctly and the sugar concentration is high in the blood of diabetics, they actually end up with a higher risk of cancer.
Sorry.
I was going to say the house is haunted.
Yeah.
Well, we know that metformin actually helps the body utilize the sugar and modifies the liver's generation of sugar. But in addition to that, in the lab, we've shown actually that metformin inhibits the stem cells via a specific signaling pathway called STAT3. And metformin has now been tested in early stage breast cancer patients after they've been done with their chemotherapy. Does giving metformin reduce the risk of the cancer coming back or not? Dr. Pamela Goodwin, who's an investigator from Canada, ran that trial with NIH support. We are now testing it in patients with BRCA1, BRCA2 mutations who don't already have cancer. Can we prevent cancer in the first place by trying to target those stem cells?
What are the side effects of that drug?
Actually, it's very, right. It's very, very well tolerated. There's a lactic acidosis that can happen that's very rare. But other than that, the side effects are pretty tolerable. Tamoxifen has all of the side effects attendant with menopause, the hot flashes, the hormonal milieu changes, and vaginal dryness, all of those issues can be, yes, can be a huge issue.
Which is why no one wants to take it.
Mm-hmm. And tamoxifen actually only reduces the risk of recurrence of estrogen receptor positive cancer. It does not protect you from an estrogen receptor negative cancer. And the people with the triple negatives and the ER negative DCIS actually have the higher risk. And yet we have nothing to offer them for continued protection. So that's why I'm very passionate that we need more of this nutritional research to be able to find the answers to help.
And would you say that sugar, which 99% of us are addicted to, is one of the main things we should avoid at all costs?
I would say moderation and reaching for whole food sources of that sugar as opposed to the refined white sugar. It makes a difference in how the body utilizes that sugar. Is it agave syrup or is it raw honey or is it just sucrose, the table sugar that you're eating? There are actually studies that have compared and have shown that it's the refined sugars and fructose syrup, that corn syrup, that is more carcinogenic. I don't think the one inherent taste we're all born with as infants is that attraction to the sweet. It's on the front of our tongue, and that's what causes us to drink the milk as humans. So I don't think it's natural to say avoid at all costs. But there is a way to moderate and balance with complex carbohydrates and grains. The soluble fiber in complex carbohydrates actually slows down your body's absorption of sugar. And that helps your body metabolize it and use it more efficiently if it's absorbed more slowly. You're welcome. You're welcome.
Wow.